grad student. Wow, I missed y'all. You may have noticed that we did not have an episode out last week, and for many of us, it was finals and the semester was wrapping up, and that was true for me. But last week was also the moment that my partner and I have been waiting for this whole past year. He finally graduated from nursing school. Yes, so I took a week off because hashtag boundaries, but I'm super happy to be back. That being said, so many of you have also defended or are about to defend their masters and their PhDs and are now entering into the big scary world that is life past grad school, or you're on to the next stage of grad school, which is still scary. So that's where today's episode comes in. I really hope that it's helpful for all of your post-PhD and master's needs. And if you are somebody who is making this transition, that means that you are now a master or a doctor. And congratulations from the Dear Grad Student Podcast. I am extremely jealous and I'm extremely proud of you. Anyways, today's episode is all about transitioning out of grad school with Assistant Professor Dr. Maddie Orr. Hello, listeners. Welcome back to Dear Grad Student, the podcast where grad students can come together to celebrate, commiserate, and support one another through this long and difficult journey. I'm Alana. I'm a fourth-year doctoral student and your host, and I'm joined today by an assistant professor in sports management researching sport ecology, Dr. Maddie Orr. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Alana. Thanks for having me.
You are so welcome. Thanks for being here. This is a big moment because you are not the first person with a PhD to come on this podcast, but you are the first person who is an assistant professor, post-PhD, still in academia to be here, and I am really excited for that. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I think it's like, there's so many things that I wish I knew going into grad school. Like every step of it was just very opaque. So I feel like this podcast needs to exist and I'm excited to be part of it.
Thanks. Like I said, super excited to have you. And the things we talked about beforehand, y'all, you just wait for what we got for you today. But before we jump into that, I want to make sure people can find you online, connect with you, see where you're at. So where can the people find you online?
Yeah, so the easiest place is Twitter. I'm a bit of a Twitter nerd. So at Maddie J. Orr on Twitter. And then I also have a website, madelineorr.com.
There you go. Those, of course, will both be linked in the description. Everyone who listens to this podcast every week, you already know that. And new people, hello, welcome. It'll be in the description. All right. Well, before we start talking about transitioning out of grad school, first off, I've been really looking forward to doing this episode. And I just told myself, I was like, do it at the end of second semester when people are actually doing this. So I feel like all year I've been like, that's been hanging out on like this release date, just waiting to happen. But before we jump in, I want to hear a little bit about what are your research interests? What do you do? What field are you in? Just to give everybody who's listening a context, especially for some of the things you've already told me about your journey that are probably a little bit unique to you and that field and so on.
Yeah. So I actually started undergrad in international development and it was too doom and gloom for me. I just like couldn't do all the like heavy big problems all the time with like it seemingly not enough solutions. So by the time I started looking at grad school, I wanted something a little more tangible. I wanted to sink my teeth into like just one area or just one domain and figure out the problems there. And so I ended up going into like the event management, sport management world, largely because like at the time I thought planning events was fun. Like that was the logic. It really wasn't that sophisticated. So went into that, really enjoyed it, discovered pretty quickly through like a gap year and some weird experiences in early grad school that my real interest is sport ecology, which like is a term that essentially I invented with some colleagues.
Nice.
That didn't exist before. Yeah.
I love that.
But essentially it means sport ecology is the study of sport and the natural environment and the relationship between the two. So if we're going to host an Olympics, for example, as like an extreme example, there's going to be a whole bunch of emissions and waste and pollution tied to that. So let's learn to measure that and quantify it so that we can do better in terms of reducing and offsetting. The other kind of flip side in my focus is how is climate change and environmental condition change impacting sport? So will skiing be tenable 50 years from now?
Wow.
You know, what's happening to golf courses on the coast when sea levels rise? How do athletes handle extreme heat? I kind of marry the sports med world with environmental science, with management, and you know, take the available data that's there, marry it, come up with policy recommendations. And I work with industry pretty closely on getting those implemented as well.
So that's extremely casual. But the other thing you just reminded me of is that you worked at the Olympics, right? Did I read that right?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So it's actually a funny story. I took a gap year and went to France after my master's to work in the ski industry.
I'm like, as one skier. Does.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those, it like sounds super bougie, but like you're living in like the basement of a hotel.
Nice.
With like 30 other staff in like rooms that look like dorms that are shitty. And like, it's a beautiful place to be, but like the work is very basic. I went out to be a ski bum and realized pretty quick that it was going to look weird that season because we didn't have any snow. So I get out there like in November and picture this, there's like no snow until January 9th.
Whoa.
Really? Yeah. Whoa. My parents came out for Christmas and they like looked around. They're like, cool. So this is the Alps at Christmas. And so, yeah. So like this really weird experience, because what happens when you don't have snow, and I learned this the hard way, is like injury rates go up because you're skiing on fake snow, which is essentially slush or ice. So injury rates go up. When the snow comes, you get avalanches because it crusts differently. So it was the deadliest year for avalanches on both sides of the Atlantic.
Oh my gosh.
The tourism industry suffers because obviously people like cancel their ski holidays or like go to the city instead. And so you start to see like we had restaurants shutting their doors. We had people in our town whose contracts were ended early, like around Christmas, because the people were like, we can't guarantee we're going to have a job for you in a month. Yeah, it was a really weird experience. So in that mess of like realizing, this is what climate change does to the world.
Holy crap.
So I had that wake up call, and like January 9th, the snow came. On January 15th, I like got into like a bad ski accident and blew out my knee completely.
Oh.
And so like while the whole ski industry was suffering, I was sitting in the hospital along with all the other suckers who got injured.
Oh.
And realizing like, okay, this is going to be a really long recovery, because it was everything. It was ACL, PCL, both meniscus and MCL.
Oh my God.
Differing degrees. Yeah. So like I've had multiple surgeries to fix that since then, but it was going to cut my season. And so I actually got, and like, I love this word, repatriated to Canada back home and to get surgery. Cause they're like, we can't do like all of the recovery that this is going to take. Cause it's like months of physio plus surgery plus recovery after. And my visa would have expired in that time. So they sent me home, in like late February. So like I was there for another month and a bit, which was great. Cause I got to like be with everybody, which is cool.
Yeah.
And like see what happens when the snow comes back, which was interesting as well. So I'm back at home in February, and like I don't start my PhD till September. And I'm thinking like, okay, I gotta figure something out here. Like I'm gonna go crazy if I'm sitting on my parents' couch recovering from surgeries. And so I started LinkedIn like messaging different people, like that cold calling thing that undergrads do.
Oh my gosh.
I like, I'm the biggest proponent. Like, please, if you're listening, like go create your own opportunities. They exist and they're cool. And I came across a company that was based in the US. So I'm Canadian. This is a company based in the US that did tours and travel planning for a bunch of different Team USA teams. And I messaged them, was just like, hey, like I have a master's in international event management. I just worked in the ski industry, managing all their, basically like their events and their travel within France, Italy, and Switzerland. That was my job when I was there. I would love to like help you out at the Olympics. I don't need to be paid, basically. Like, just let me come. And they wrote back and they're like, yeah, like we'd love to have you. We'll pay you. No problem. Like, come join our team.
Oh my God. And then,
so I spoke to them on the phone like the next day after that like cold email. And they were like, yeah, no problem. Like, we'll book your flight. Come out. And we'll put you up. So it was like a very weird experience. And then about a month later, I landed quote unquote an internship, but like it wasn't really, because it was paid, and it was like a seasonal coordinator position for the Olympic team, for Team Canada canoe kayak. And so like I went down basically to work with both different organizations. And so I had essentially the friends and family program, like, which is PR and relations with like the team and like their friends and family. And you become the point person for like the media, but also the family members to get to the athletes, because we don't want them distracted, right? So like, if you're going to compete today, we really need Alana to have her head on straight, and like mom and dad can't be texting her being like, hey, when's your event? Like that can go through me. That doesn't have to be Alana. So I went down and spent like, I was there for about 2 months and went to at least one event every day of the Olympics.
Oh my God.
It was pretty incredible. I was literally standing on the track, or like just like on the edges of the track, like to go to the underground when Usain Bolt ran.
Oh my God.
And just cool stuff. Like I got a really, really great experience through that. And yeah, I wouldn't trade it for the world. I learned a lot there too, though, right? Like you go and when you're in the inside, you see, you know, how much waste is produced.
Yeah.
You see like the boxes of gear and giveaways that like sit behind the stands and everything in the box is like wrapped in single packaging. You're just like, that's so unnecessary.
Yeah.
And you see like how pissed off the locals are, right? Like they don't show it on TV, but like there were protests every single day in Copacabana, which is like one of their nicer areas. Yeah. Every single day of the Olympics, there were protests about the Olympics because the government spent so much money on it and displaced like tens of thousands of people who lived in favelas to make the village. And people were pretty pissed off and like rightfully so.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was my gap year. Like that's how I really like cemented in my mind this idea that like sport is so intricately connected to the natural environment. And like, we have to take that more seriously and, you know, acknowledge that and respond appropriately when like the conditions of the environment change. So like France, but also like take better care of the planet because we literally depend on it for food, air, water, so on and so forth.
Wow. That might be the coolest story that has ever been told on this podcast. There's been a lot of stories told, so I can't be held liable for that statement, but what a way to spend a gap year and no pun intended, find a gap in the research and really find a niche. It also really reminds me, this is something that my partner talks about a lot with the Olympics. We love the Olympics, but we have similar conversations. And it reminds me about like on Facebook, you'll see those posts of like Beijing and the stadiums that are just left completely desolate as well. So you also have the like long term of like they're displacing people and then it's just left for what? Rot.
Yeah.
So that's really, really interesting. And I'm like suddenly very like, I'm like, oh, I wonder what she's written. I might go read after the podcast. But very cool. I do want to transition to talking a little bit about then, you know, that was your gap year, what your grad school experience was like and sort of leading into that transition out of grad school. And just for anybody listening, for just a little bit of context, Maddie graduated grad school in 2020, which is quite a time. Her last year of grad school is quite a story, not a lot of fun, but got the PhD. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. But your sort of general grad school experience and preparing for that transition, tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So grad school for me actually started before my gap year. I did a master's in Europe the year before. And so, but I like kind of like put that in a box because like it was a great experience. It was a very different system in Europe. So when I got, after my gap year, I went to the University of Minnesota and the School of Kinesiology, which is in the College of Education. And I went there because my research, like quote unquote, was about sports and really quickly found out that like actually my research is more about climate change and natural resources and like management policy, you know, how sports organizations interact with their city governments, so on and so forth. Right. So like, yes, it's sports, but super loosely, like that's more of a context than anything. Mm-hmm. And so I got to Minneapolis and my advisor was like an absolute gem. This is at a time when my advisor, like I was his second grad student or PhD student. So like a bit of a guinea pig still. Mm-hmm. But he was just such a champion. Like, shout out to Yuhei Inoue if you're listening in Manchester.
Amazing.
But he, like, absolutely championed me right from the get-go and was like, yep, if you want to, you know, learn about natural resources and that, like, go do it 100%. But, like, I can't support you there because it's just, like, not my space.
Sure.
And so, so I get to Minneapolis. Within, like, 2 months, I applied to do a master's at the same time in natural resource science and management and had an amazing advisor over there, too. So by my second semester, I was in two programs full time, taking courses in both with two separate advisors and two separate schools. So it was very kind of weird. Like sometimes PhD students will add a master's, but it'll be close enough that it like at least is in the same school, for example.
Yeah.
Mine was like totally different. Like one was on the St. Paul campus, one was on the Minneapolis campus. I was shuttling between them.
Oh, wow.
But I had like really, really honestly great advisors who were just super supportive and like understood what I was trying to do by marrying these two things.
Yeah.
And so good first couple years. I will say the way grad schools in the US that I've been in overwork grad students is like not okay. And I definitely had that experience. Yeah.
Yep.
So I was a TA in my first semester and I wanted to teach because I knew I needed that experience. I didn't expect it would be like, yeah, here's two sections like within your first year. I was just kind of like always doing too much teaching. Like I taught 2 to 3 courses basically every semester and summer, like starting in first year. And like, I want to emphasize this, like I never actually took a sport class. because I came out of international event management. So yeah. Like I'd worked in sports a little bit before doing my gap year. I worked with Spartan Race for a couple of years, which is a company based in Boston. And also shout out to them because like they do really cool stuff. So like I had some like on the ground experience, but like I was really flying blind. And like Shout out to the students as well who were just like so cool about it and like provided amazing feedback. And I really learned from that.
That reminds me that I taught 4 courses my first semester. They were lab courses, but I had 4 of them and they were each 2-hour labs.
Right. Awful. Like awful. And also like when you're trying to take, like I always did that stupid thing. And like, please, if you're listening, don't do this. I assumed that classes in grad school were kind of similar to classes in undergrad. We're like, you can totally take 5, no problem. Like, don't do that because they're not the same. So I landed myself in like some really heavy semesters there at the beginning, but like kind of quickly became like the golden child of my department. So like I did the 3-minute thesis and then I won. And then I went to the grad level, like the university wide level, did really well, went to like Midwest finals. Like,
wow.
Would really, really encourage that. And that experience helped me to narrow in on like, oh, there's a lot to be said for being able to communicate your research succinctly and like that it's super important and this is what's going to get you a job. So really enjoyed that experience and it kind of endeared me to the department a little bit, which was cool because I like got to know professors I never would have known because they're like, oh, hi, Maddie. And I'm like, you know my name. Okay. Because you just feel like a lowly grad student, right? Like it's just this grind and you feel like you're on this path and like, it's just like you do whatever you can, but like these departments can be so big.
Yes.
So like you kind of stick to your lab and stick to your research group. But like I decided I wasn't going to do that and it worked out, but it was like a very weird path. So definitely overworked, exhausted all the time, teaching all the time, teaching in the summer. They sent me to China to teach a class after my first year, which was amazing. Yeah. Which was really, really cool. So I got to go there. I really can't speak highly enough of like how amazing that program was for the first years, which is why when I left in third year, so the summer before third year, I actually met my partner who's now my fiance and he is doing his PhD at McGill. So he was in Montreal and I was in Minneapolis, which is like a 2-hour flight. And that wasn't going to work.
Right, right.
So I started looking around for like, okay, how do we make this work a little better? And I got a call over the summer from my mom. My parents are professors. My mom's university was looking for someone to step in for a 1-year position. I got a call on like August 15th being like, hey, do you want to start like next week and teach a couple classes and be like a full-time faculty member for the year?
Oh my God.
Yeah. Can you do a phone interview in like 2 days? So I said yes, because like as a grad student, that's what you say. And then, So I ended up getting it and spending a year at Laurentian University in Canada, which was like much, much closer, like 6-hour drive as opposed to like 2-hour flight.
Oh, yeah.
So that was great. But the University of Minnesota freaked out a little bit that they were losing labor. And like, that's really what it came down to. Like, it wasn't about me as a student or like what was best for me or my well-being. Like at that point, I had finished all my courses. I was about to take my comps. They pushed my comps, which like I kind of understood because like the conditions had changed and like it wasn't as easy to administer them. And anyway, fine. But they got pushed by like a semester. So that just delayed me a semester basically for no reason because I wasn't allowed to take thesis credits before taking my comps. So I ended up like, really annoying. So they delayed my comps, but like whatever it was, what it was, they went well. I did them literally over Christmas. I did them like, I got them on the 22nd of December and did them through January 2nd.
Wow, that sucks.
Yeah, because I was teaching full time that year. And so I needed it to be on my break. And by the end of that year, I got a full time faculty job at SUNY Cortland. And so like by fourth year, I was full-time faculty at SUNY Cortland.
While a grad student.
And so like a very weird, like my first 2 years at Minnesota were like everything you could possibly want out of a grad program. And then like, as soon as I started like doing something a little different than the path, it seemed like the department was like, what the hell do we do with this person?
Yeah.
Which like, okay, you know, I get it a little bit. Like it's hard when people like don't follow the system.
I would say they want you to play by their rules and they have that control and that like ownership.
Yeah. Yeah. And to an extent, I like, especially now as a faculty member, like I understand why that is and like where it comes from. Sure. That said, I think like there's a reason grad students need different resources and supports. And like there are new 2 grad students who are the same. So this idea that everybody's going to follow the same path, like I think we really need to drop that because it's outdated and unhelpful.
Absolutely.
So fourth year, I am still in my PhD program. I'm starting at SUNY Cortland. And I learn at the beginning of my fourth year that you're laughing because you've heard the story.
Yes.
That Minnesota is going to pull all my funding. And so
The guaranteed funding.
Yeah. So when I went to Minnesota, I actually got a fellowship and I have to teach myself to say this. I earned a fellowship.
Hey, you say that. You earned it. That's right.
I earned a fellowship when I got there, and it's 4 years of guaranteed funding. So it's like, it does not say it's tied to teaching or research. It says that like that might be part of it, but it does not say like that is how it works. It's just 4 years guaranteed funding. So this is my fourth year. I should be totally fine. And I told my department, I was like, I'm happy to do a research assistantship from afar. I'm happy to be a TA from afar. Some of our courses at the time were already being delivered partially online. So like there were TAs who were on campus TAing online.
And this is fall 2019.
This is fall 2019.
Let's just do
yeah.
some dates here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So this is like the semester before COVID hits. So like I'm starting a new job. I get told you're going to pay like $10,000 to $13,000 a semester because you're an international student tuition to finish this thing. Meanwhile, like it's basically done. Like the draft was done in September. So I told them I'm going to take a semester leave to figure this out because like, I'm not about to do this. Like I'm not fighting with you. I'm not doing this dance.
Yeah.
I'm taking a leave of absence. I'll start my job and then I will finish. I'm not worried about it. Like I know the draft is done. I know it's good. So like I'm giving myself a minute. So I take a leave of absence. And then in November, I start like emailing them saying, okay, do you have a TA appointment for me in the like spring? Like, is there any way that I can get that funding back so that I can defend and finish this thing? By November, during that leave of absence, like I finished it. It was written. It was ready to be submitted. They said no. So I started talking to people at the faculty, like in other faculties, asking what they'd done in similar circumstances. I learned that like other departments in our same school had allowed people to work remotely. I actually like, it was just very weird.
It was just you.
It was just seemingly like just me. And
good,
like,
good.
They didn't want to quote unquote set a bad precedent that like you could work remotely, which is like in hindsight, absolutely hilarious.
It's honestly just like thinking about that now, what an outdated statement. I mean, I'm sure they're going to be back on that bullshit a year from now, but like, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you were just like 6 months early. Do you know what I mean? Like,
that's what I mean. And like, not even like November to March, right? So like
yeah.
5 months. Yeah. So I ended up like talking to lawyers, trying to figure it out. So I actually went to the ombudsman at the university to be like, what can you do to help me? Because my department, like the whole department, including my advisor, seem to be like under the impression that this is impossible when it's actively happening elsewhere in our department and elsewhere on campus. But like, because the person is based in Minneapolis, it's fine. Whereas like I'm based in New York and that's not fine. And they basically wrote back and they're like, because there's nothing written on this, like we can't advocate for you or against you. Like we can't even be involved. And I'm like, what's the point of an ombudsperson?
So
then I talked to the lawyers on campus and they said the same thing. They're like, because it's not explicitly written in your contract, like they can choose to administer this however they choose to. And like, ooh, it's their call.
I love that really special like flavor of abuse just like woven in.
Yeah. Just like extra special, like your department can choose exactly how this goes. You have no say. And regardless of the fact that there are like exceptions being made left, right, and center for everybody else, like, no, you don't get to
well,
argue
like,
that point.
Let's not forget, like, this is happening to you because of success. Like, yeah. That was my initial thing of like, hang on, you have this grad student who is
yeah.
has a tenure track position that she's working while finishing your program. Like,
yeah.
Don't you want to champion that person and be like, look at the student we have coming out of our program? No, instead you want what? An extra 6 months of, no, she's ours. Like, come, like, I don't actually yeah. understand that logic. Like, I mean, I'll just brag on you a little bit, having read your CV, like you're doing media interviews, like you're somebody who is like now on the Forbes list of 30 under 30. Like you are a great alumni of that program. And like, I mean, from the outside perspective, I feel like they kind of failed you. Like, you're not going to be like, I don't know, prancing around being like my program who supported me on like blah, blah, blah. And that's a shame. You know, like they had yeah. the option.
I agree. That's what's so hard is like, it was such a, like, they were so great and supportive and like, yay, Maddie Orr, when I was there. And then it felt like the second I had a different idea of like what I wanted to do or how yeah. I wanted to do it, the whole narrative changed. And it was like, wait a second, I'm still that student who's like
kicking ass.
Yeah, like I'm publishing multiple papers a semester. Like I'm teaching your classes. I'm doing all the things. Like I'm not really sure what more you want. I yeah. like except for me to be physically on campus so that you can parade me. Like I'm not really sure what this is. So that's when it became like very apparent to me that the system is very broken. And again, like I don't know that it's individual people who are there who right. are like that it's like their fault. I think just like everybody is so baked into the system.
Yes,
they like
yes.
don't see how ridiculous that was. And I wonder if I haven't asked them, but like part of me wants to write them a letter and be like, hi, I kindly request an apology for like the ridiculousness and the $13,000
you charged
me. Can I
have my $13,000? Well, yeah. So let's tell the story of you like spending this $13,000 then.
So after going to the ombudsperson and lawyers and different people trying to figure out like, how do I get my fellowship money that like I was guaranteed was a contract?
Yeah.
And being told like, essentially they get to administer it however the hell they want. And like fellowship is different than a job. And like, you don't necessarily have anything here.
Oh, another line of abuse. A fellowship is different than a job. We pay you, but we control you. Really?
Yeah.
Just so healthy. Really?
Yeah.
Healthy.
So if you're listening, like, pay close attention to your fellowship rules. And even if they say that something is the way it is, it's not necessarily. So double check it with every person you can ask. So I get into my last semester and like, bearing in mind, like I submitted my thesis to my committee, like in the fall when I was on that quote unquote leave of absence, they like set a defense date February, 2020. And I like knew it was coming. And so I had to pay tuition in order to be eligible to defend. You have to be like an active student. And so sucked it up, paid the tuition, gutted my heart. And it's a lot of money. Like when you're a new professor, particularly like smaller state schools, like you don't get paid a whole lot. And I was teaching a 3-3 plus a winter course plus a summer course, like to like pick up extra money to like make it happen. Because like coming out of grad school, I didn't have any money. Like I was a grad student, like who makes money in grad school?
No one.
Yeah, nobody. And so being told like, okay, you're going to like live by yourself in like upstate New York and float that. And then also like, you're going to pay 10 grand tuition up front. So I did that. I ended up paying it, whatever. Went to campus, defended, literally was on campus. Like we booked a room, a classroom that was empty from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. for my defense. I think I got there like 15 minutes early to set up and left at like 11:05. Period. That was it. That was the only time I was on campus all semester. I don't use their library anymore because I was at a new university that had a great library. Sure. I don't like use any of the resources. I just like was there for 2 hours. Anyways, that cost $10,000, which like just if you're wondering where your tuition goes, I'm also not sure. And, and yeah. And then like 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later, COVID hit and everybody goes remote. And all of a sudden, like, this is the norm and this is the actual recommended way of working. So that was my grad school experience. And then on top of like add insult to injury, like, cause it's COVID, like I couldn't even like, we had plans, my family. So I'm like the first PhD in my family, which like my parents are professors, but they're in the arts. And so like, they never like, they've been sitting on stages forever. My dad is a professor at the university. I did my undergrad, was on the stage at my undergrad graduation as a faculty member. Like,
so cool.
Yeah. And like, then I go, this is like the first big graduation for my family and like got canceled. So it was just like a very weird, like bitter end to the PhD process.
Yeah.
And by the time I left, like both of the internal people in my department who are on my committee have since left the department. One of the externals is now the Commissioner of Commerce in the state of Minnesota, Steve Kelly. And shout out to him. He was a champion for me. He was amazing.
Love it.
Nothing but support all the way through. Ingrid Schneider, who was in like a totally different school. She was in the School of Natural Resource Science. She was my master's advisor. She's on my PhD committee, also an absolute champion. Like the people were great. It's just like very interesting to see like how none of them are actually in the department anymore.
Yeah, that is so interesting. So obviously you had a very unconventional journey.
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah, getting the job early on like you did, COVID hitting when it did, having to do the tuition, just like really the bureaucracy that like just kind of got in the way for no good reason, like because you had success, ?
Yeah.
So obviously like that all went down and you transitioned then during COVID sort of right into a tenure track position that sounds like it was probably also online because COVID hit. So doing all that for the first time, I guess thinking about what this transition was like, more on a personal level, what was that like for you to go from a place of student to a place of faculty, to a place of I am in this role now? And hearing your story, you know, you were teaching for many years and you were in this 1 year, you know, tenure track position at one point in Canada. So maybe your transition was easier, but what was that like on a personal level to sort of even make that move?
Yeah. So the best analogy I have, and I don't know if everyone's going to catch this, but so I was a person who had like the extraordinary privilege of going to summer camp as a kid for a few years.
Me too.
Yeah. Love it. And then I ended up going back on staff. I was there for 7 years on staff.
Oh no.
I
already know where this is going because same.
So being a young faculty member is like being stuck in CIT hell and like counselor in training, right? And like, it's this weird thing because like I got to campus in Canada and then I got to campus in upstate New York, and at both places, like grad students would like invite me to parties in the hall. There's a lot of mistaking you for a student that happens if you come out of grad school young and look young. So that happened a lot. I, in my first semester, had like a group of students, and this might have just been like the group of students, but like it was pretty egregious, who showed up, and like of the 32 of them, only 2 or 3 had done the assignment, because they're like, oh, it's fine. Like, you're cool, right? You're a friend. Like, you're going to just write this
out. Yikes.
So there was like a weird moment that kind of like stretched a lot longer than I thought it would, of like finding my legs as a prof and like finding the sense of authority that comes with that, but also like trying to be conscious of the fact that like I'm not actually trying to be an authority. I'm trying to be like a supportive mentor, leader, educator, and not a person who's just like here to uphold the system and like grade you angrily.
Well, especially after your experience.
Yeah. So like here I am trying to like be the cool prof and like getting mistaken for like their friend and then like a fellow student. So like it's just like weird. Actually, like even just yesterday, I was at the store with my partner dropping off my bike for a tune-up, and like the store clerk is just like, oh, are you a student here? And I was just like, nope, I'm a professor. And he was like, oh, because, okay. Which like is like double-edged sword, right? Like super flattering on one side, because you're just like, yes, like I love that like they come that young. But the other part of me is just like,
Take me seriously. Yeah.
Like, okay, got to put that blazer back on now.
Like, yeah. It reminds me of like when I walk around campus. I mean, I am 25 and I still walk around campus in like leggings and Birks
100%.
And like sweatshirt and like school gear. Cause this is just what I wear. You know, my friends, like a lot of them work on college campuses and like different student leader roles, whatever. Like my friends wear college clothes. I wear college clothes. So I know for a fact, despite the fact that I'm 25 and a fourth year grad student, that I would be mistaken for an undergrad like it's nothing. Absolutely no question. And it was also weird for me. Like this is really reminding me of my transition to grad school, because I went right from undergrad to grad school. I didn't have any gap time. So I went within the 3-month period from having a TA to being a TA. And the students that entered that class, I had only just turned 22, like a few months before starting grad school. And the students were 18. So I was 4 years older than them and had just earned the degree 3 months prior that they had.
Yeah.
And it was weird.
When the first class I taught at Minnesota was Capstone, so 4th years, and I was 22, and we had, I think it was like 13 of the students in the class were older than me, because they were 20, like I was had just turned 22, and they were all like 22 or 23, because a bunch of our students were 5th years because of a number of different reasons. Like we have a really great partnership with military, so we get a lot of vets who come through, so they're a little older. And so like I had a bunch of students who were like my age and older, and it was like, and I didn't have the degree they had. I had like a totally different thing. It was like, totally, I'm going to teach you 4th year sports. Let's go.
Right. I also think that your analogy with summer camp is excellent. Yeah. at my summer camp, it was SIT, so staff in training, not just counselor, right? And it's sort of that in between of like you have privileges, but not the same, right? So counselors in training, they always had an earlier bedtime. There were only certain days they could have their phone. Like they couldn't leave campus, things like that. So it's sort of like the privileges, but not really. And I just think that's a great analogy. And you also get like mistaken as a camper. And it's always the question of like, are you a camper? Are you a staff? And at my camp, they finally were like, SITs are campers. They pay to be here. And also that was like, staff can't hook up with SIT. You know, so it was like also lines they were drawing there. It's a good analogy because you're sort of like a baby grown up.
They call it baby doc for a reason, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I can't relate because I don't have a doctorate, nor do I have a tenure track job lined up. I have to imagine.
It's like a very interesting. And also like, so if you happen to be a person who gets a tenure track job before you finish, right? There's a few things that are going to be in that contract that you should be aware of. First thing is they're going to tell you how long you have to finish. So it's totally possible to get a job ABD. And I had a great experience with it. My faculty at Cortland were super supportive of the fact that like I was still finishing. They like gave me a few days off to go and defend, which like is just lovely of them. Yeah, like they just were really great. I got back to campus like the next week and like a few of them took me out for brunch before my like first class back as a doc. So like, they're just like, it was really great. But like there are some things that like it just adds a new dimension just to be aware. So like if you're a person who's getting one of those contracts, like pay attention to how much much time you have. And if they say, often they'll say like within 6 months or a year, ask for longer than you need, just in case, because there's so many elements of that defense process. And like, not just the defense process, but like submitting to the library is just, it's just such a hassle. So like, it might have nothing to do with you. But like, I, for example, defended. So I had a year, which was like, I knew, like by the time I signed my contract, I knew it was going to be fine. But I defended in February and it took like over a month. Like I defended with no real edits and it took over a month just to like format certain pages for the library. And so like officially I like finished in March of 2020, which like, again, is totally fine. But like, I can see how that would maybe like, if you had edits after your defense, maybe that's a month. And then like, submitting to libraries a month, and then maybe like you've got something else. Like, I don't know, right? So like, give yourself a little bit more than you need, because you don't want to be on that. Like, I could have, mine would have worked almost exactly for 6 months, but I'm so glad I had the year, just because it's just like not a stress in that situation. And like, you're already doing a new job and like, you don't need that.
So thinking about that, and you're, you know, just about a year past finishing up, congratulations.
Thanks.
What do you wish you knew before graduating with your PhD?
Oh,
and you're the first person, I think, to answer this on the podcast. No pressure.
Okay. Got to get this right.
No, it's good. It's good.
Okay. So a few things like kind of come to mind. The first one is you're like exactly the same person and you don't know any more than you think, like that you thought you would. So like the imposter syndrome and the feeling like you can never read enough doesn't go away.
Oh, lovely. So, great.
Yeah. Like, sorry to report.
But also maybe I should work on that now then.
But that's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. So like, there's a certain, like, I think I held on to a little bit of like, okay, like once I get it and I have the letters, like there will be a certain amount that I can relax. I would just like caution against that and start to learn how to manage those expectations while you're in grad school, so that like you don't get out and then discover like, oh, actually, like in my case, like I was way more busy at the end than I was when I was in. And like, it would have been really cool to learn how to like take free time when I was in.
Yeah.
So that was one piece. The other one is like, there's this weird, and we were talking about it before we started recording, but like this weird piece about like, how do you want to be called?
Mm.
And
you were like, sometimes I want a Jill Biden it. And I loved that.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, I definitely do have moments where I'm just like, we got to Jill Biden this and go with doctor. And then like, and there's some people who are going to do it anyway, which is awesome. And like, the default should be that people doctor you automatically. Like, that should be like out of respect. It's not always how it goes. And sometimes like, it's a weird, it becomes this weirdly political, like personal thing, right? Where people will not call you doctor. And like, you're not sure if it's a slight or like being friendly. And then like other times, like they will, and then you correct them and just be like, yeah, no worries, just call me Maddie. And then it just like is a very weird thing, right? Especially when you're young. So like, if you happen to be a grad student who's going to be young when this ends, it gets even weirder, right?
Great.
Like, I finished
things to look forward to.
Yeah, right. And like, I finished in like my mid to late 20s, and like, it's a weird one. It's a weird one. And I, you know, I tell everybody who will listen, and like, it's on my website, like, my name is Madeline Orr, but like, please just call me Maddie, and it doesn't have to be doctor, and like, that's cool. But then like, if I'm at an event and I'm on like a list of panelists and everybody else is going by doctor, like, and you don't add it to my name, like, then I'm like, okay, yeah, I know I said call me Maddie, but like, don't take away my credentials either. Like,
yeah.
So it just like is this weird piece that I think like everybody just figures out how to navigate over time.
Sure.
So not a big one, but just like, figure out early what you want, I guess. And so like, my go-to now is like, on paper, Dr. Maddie Orr. In person, call me Maddie. And then like, it's just easy. But students always doctor or prof. And a big part of that is like setting boundaries, because they like thought I was their friend for a while, which is a weird experience. Very much that like staff SIT situation.
Yep.
And then I think like the last one is just, academia is weird for everybody. Like, it is a weird system. It was designed at a time when it was old white dudes who would like write down their ideas based on very little and, I don't know, hammer it to the front of a church or write it in these old books that only certain people could read. And like, that was how knowledge was formed. Like, that's not the way of the world anymore, right? Like, we still work in systems where, you know, most of our institutions, if you go back like 60 years, like, didn't have women, certainly didn't have many people of color. And that's like totally changed how these organizations should work, but it hasn't, in the sense that like, we still see syllabi. Like, if you pull up a syllabus from like 1960, aside from it being like digitally written now, like, it looks very similar.
Mm-hmm.
So when you come out, you have a little bit more, like, as a prof, you have a little bit more power to change things than you do as like a grad instructor or a GA or a TA. And if you are feeling bold, so bold, I would encourage you to use it, because it's like a really cool experience to be able to do things like adding parenting policies to your syllabus. And like, I don't really care what my department says, because like my chair's not going to say anything because they can't really, there's a certain degree of academic freedom involved in that. You know, like there's certain things you can do. Like you can choose to not use a textbook, for example, for like equity reasons, but also mm-hmm. because textbooks are typically written by advanced academics that tends to be men, typically older dudes and who are mostly white. Like, yeah, not exclusively, right? And so like, you know, I went through my undergrad and like, I'm pretty sure I had in like all the classes I took in undergrad, I went back and like looked at syllabi. Like, I think I maybe had two textbooks that were written by a woman, and like, that's wow. it. And like, that's really shitty. So like,
yeah,
how do we do better? And like, I really have a lot of faith in this next generation of like young profs coming up. And, you know, one of my colleagues, shout out to her, Lindsay Darvin, like follow her on Twitter.
Yes.
I think it's at Dr. Darvin or at Dr. Lindsay Darvin.
Anyway, I'll put her in the description. Everyone go follow her. Yeah,
totally. Go follow her. We have this conversation all the time about like, okay, like what kind of power have we just gotten that like is kind of invisible and no one wants to talk about it because they don't want to have to take on the burden. Like we want it. How do we take it on? How do we like make our classrooms a little bit better? Mm. And there's just so much more power that comes with like having the title, having the position than comes with being a grad student. So if you're lucky enough to find yourself in that position, like reach out, let us know, talk to your university, find out what resources they have. Like there's just so much more you can do from the perch of the PhD.
Absolutely. Wow. I mean, that's really great advice. And what a wonderful reflection of like the ability that you kind of now have. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that is like really the privilege, I think, in a lot of ways of that mm-hmm. academic job. I think there are likely a lot of people listening, at least this is how I am feeling. And so if you're mm-hmm. listening and feeling this way, same, who are probably thinking, wow, I want an academic job. Wow, you got an academic job second year. But who might just be thinking like, having also come out of grad school in 4 years in this assistant professor position, who are curious, like, what were the most valuable pieces of grad school? Was it writing every day? Was it publishing? Was it the service that you did? What do you think were the pieces that got you the job that it did, or that have actually translated to the job itself that you're like, mm-hmm. I wish I would have developed this more in grad school because I'm actually using this now?
Wow, so many. I am sure you've heard this before, but have friends who are not in grad school.
Yeah.
Is a really important one. And it applies like when you're in grad school, and it also applies when you leave.
Yeah.
Like having friends outside of academia really helps to remind you on a regular basis of like academia is not the whole world, even though it's going to feel like that sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really important. I'm a person who like, I love bedtime. I love bedtime. I go to bed like almost the same time every night. It's pretty early.
Well,
that's been great because yeah, a lot of people are like, that's a weird one. But for me, like that's really what keeps my energy levels as high as they are and like mm-hmm. allows me to be productive. And like different people's bodies need different things. So like maybe for you, it's like you really need to eat well, or you really need to like wake up early or do your workout or whatever it might be. That's cool. Just like figure out what it is for you. Spend time figuring it out. Don't just assume that like because a person made a YouTube video that works for you.
Oh my God. I love that you just said that.
So yeah, and like I think part of it is like coming out of a kinesiology department. My PhD is in kinesiology. Like I've spent a lot of time around learning about health behaviors and, you know, what performance looks like and what high performance looks like. Like you have to treat your body and especially like your brain and your mental health like as if you were like an Olympic athlete in your academic discipline. Like that is the mentality. And if you can figure that piece out, like it really does help. So there's a lot of pieces of that, right? Like learning what your experience is with imposter syndrome. And I say what it is because I think almost everybody's going to have it at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So figuring that out, like what works for you, what brings you back down to the planet, learning that sleeping or eating or doing whatever it is going to keep your body healthy is a big part of it. Like you have to be in it for the long haul. It can't be, oh, I'm going to mad dash it to the end of my PhD and like hope that I can maintain that pace when I'm busier as a prof. Like just don't do that to yourself.
Yeah.
Is my recommendation. So yeah, like there's a lot of different pieces in grad school that I picked up. But those are the two real big ones. It's just like, you have to imagine that like you are training as if you're preparing yourself for like a huge thing. And remembering that like, this is not a marathon because a marathon ends and hopefully like you'll have a long career in this and it doesn't. So
it sounded really hopeless at first. And then you saved it, but you were like, this isn't a marathon because it never ends. It was just like a stab in my heart. I didn't know that I needed it. But it's really true. I mean, I think I kind of had that wake up call after undergrad where it was like, get to grad school. Yeah. And then I got here and like the first semester, I was like, oh, I'm chilling because I did it. And then I was like, oh, I have to do it again. And I'm going to have to keep doing that hustle again and again. And so that was like my wake up call where I was like, I've done it. It's all done now. But turns out you have to work in grad school. And you'll not have to work as a postdoc. And then hopefully cross my fingers as tenure track.
Yeah.
I really love that your pieces of advice as well were like about taking care of like body and soul. I love that because I feel like a lot of people will give advice about like write this many papers, learn how to program. And like, yeah, all of that is like functional advice. But without the body and soul.
It's also personal. Like people, like I can't tell you how many workshops I've been to that are like, okay, like 100 words a day. Like that's how you write a PhD. Or, oh, okay, like you read one article per day and whatever, like insert task here. Like that's cool. And that works for a lot of people. Don't get me wrong. It doesn't work for everybody. I write in fits and bouts. Like I will not touch any readings or any writing for 2-3 weeks at a time. And then I'll go like 4 days where I'm like up at 7 and in bed by 11 and writing all day long. And I'll crank out 2 articles in 2 days. Like just whatever works for, and I learned how to do that because I figured out that like, that's how my body works. Like I have like these, I have to like store up energy and like bide my time and think about it and like figure it out in my head. And then I can sit down and by the time I sit down, it's going to come out and I know it's going to be fast. Like, but that's just, that's what works for me. And it doesn't work for everybody in the same way that 100 words a day doesn't work for everybody. So do not put yourself in a box like that because it doesn't work.
That is so great that you've said that because I am definitely not somebody who can do, I mean, this is going to sound awful, but I'm really bad at doing things every single day. Like the only things I do every day is like put on deodorant, brush my teeth, sleep and eat. Like I actually think that's the only, those are the only things. Anytime I try to do something every day, I can't. So I am definitely one of those people who is like a burst design, if you will, especially with having PMDD, which is like a mood disorder that goes along with my menstrual cycle. A lot of time my schedule is around that. So like I know there's going to be a couple weeks out of the month that I'm like on it like a bonnet. I mean, I can work. I'm going to be energized. And then there are going to be days where it's like, 1 30-minute Pomodoro session is it. Like I cannot do almost anything else. Or if I need to get things done, it's just going to go slowly. And there's just no point in me getting frustrated in that anymore because like I can't change the hormonal function of my body. You know what I mean? So that is something that I have learned that like only very, very recently, and I'm talking within the last month or so because I've just like recently had some, I don't know, like PMDD epiphanies. I just like can't feel guilty about the way that my body functions and works, which also is like having me kind of think about like, am I disabled? I don't really know. But it's one of those things of like grad school and academia has these expectations, maybe for what works for the majority or maybe for what a small handful of people that are talking a lot about it, it works for. But there's lots of ways to be successful. And that's something that I'm coming to grips with.
And I really like that you just said like that question of, are you disabled? Because like it is the entire point and it's not at all the point in the sense that like resources and universities are designed around what is in the DSM and like what's codified as a disability, right? And so having that conversation with yourself, possibly consulting a doctor, like super important because like you really can access more resources like once you have that lingo and that diagnosis and whatever else. But the other part of it is like, that's just not the point in the sense that like we should be able to accommodate whoever wants to enter grad school and whoever is able to like stay in it and stay motivated. Like it's hard enough to do it. So like whoever has the gall, like we should be accommodating that as faculty and as a community. And it like really sucks that it comes down to like, do you have a diagnosis sometimes? It's just like,
Right. Because I mean, and y'all who are listening to this can listen back to my episode about disabilities in grad school. Cause we talk all about, number one, what are these diagnoses based off of? Who is making them, right? The people, and I was in clinical psychology, so I was one of those people being like, oh yeah, you're disabled enough for X, and just like how kind of fucked up that is. But I'll also say, and this is just like something I haven't, I guess, explicitly talked about in the podcast, but like, you know, with the PMDD, it has actually really affected grad school this year. I think that COVID and like the stress of that, it's just like anything I was doing to mask it or like keep it at bay, it's just like, gone. Like COVID has taken that energy. And I've actually reached out to my advisor. We had a conversation about it and she was incredible. She was just like, I totally understand what it's like when your body just kind of fails you. You just don't really have control over it. And I will also say, because I like to be transparent about mental health on this podcast, and as I also like to say, only my favorite 50% of listeners are still listening this late in. So this is for y'all who actually care anyways. But I actually started an SSRI for PMDD. I was really horrified. I had a whole mental breakdown about it. Really horrified to take medication. I didn't take a Tylenol until I was in my 20s because I was like scared about what Tylenol would feel like. Yeah, so I'm like that girl. And I like started an SSRI about a week ago. And I only take it during my luteal phase, and it's like the gold standard treatment. And honestly, it immediately like changed my life. And I know it's been a week, They say that it interacts with progesterone, which causes PMDD. So it's not like depression where it takes weeks to like come on. It just starts working in 24 hours, and it did. So this is me being transparent and saying to people, like, do what you need to do to take care of you. Like, it's okay. And like I said, I trust the favorite 50% at the end here with that information. But you got to take care of you. That you're probably, I know that I am the person that gets in the way of my success most.
And I think like it's also worth mentioning, Alana and I, like, we're both white women. And so like there's a whole world of experiences that like we are not exposed to or privy to, but like take care of your communities as well. And I think that like there's a certain amount, and like I really have to like shout out to the Black Student Union at University of Minnesota and at Cortland, who have been phenomenal in developing, creating, and deploying resources for our Black student communities on both campuses with regard to like mental health, community well-being, resilience, which like should not be something they have to endure, but something that's going on right now. And so I think like this is something that I don't understand. I am extraordinarily sympathetic to, and like sometimes it's not like your body is failing you. It's like society has failed you, and that is totally shit and not your fault.
Absolutely.
And like if there are ways that the system can support you, like ask for that help, and hopefully you have profs who will hear that. Because like it might not be like a DSM thing that's getting in the way of your world. Like it might be the world getting in the way. And like that again is not your fault. So the grad experience is gonna look different for everybody, and just being sensitive to like those differences and the resources that are available and the resources that are not. Like if there's something that you need that's not on campus, it's not available to you, it's not available through grad student insurance, which at most places is like pretty decent, like ask for it.
Yeah.
Because you'd be amazed what you can get if you ask. And I've seen some people come out with like some pretty great outcomes.
Yeah. Wow. Incredible. Once again on this podcast, we've gone so many different places, despite the fact that we had one theme going into this conversation. And with that, I do want to move on to final thoughts. This is our last little segment, if you will, for the podcast. And for everybody listening, of course, these are just some like summarizing points, some takeaways, some things that Maddie and I hope that you remember walking away from this episode. And I always like to have manners and let the guest go first. So Maddie, what are your final thoughts? What are some takeaways that you hope anyone listening remembers from this and maybe utilizes in their life or what have you?
Yeah, I love this question. So I have two that kind of like stand out. One is there is no normal grad student experience. They will tell you that. They will recruit you to a program, them being like the faculty and whoever might be involved in that process. They'll recruit you to a program saying like, Alana, it's going to be 4 years. It's going to be this. We're going to try to get you to publish. We're going to send you to a conference. It's going to be fabulous. You maybe teach. Like, but the reality is like, it never actually goes the way they say. And the reason that doesn't happen exactly is because their grad students are different people. Like, we are not robots. It doesn't work that way. And so bucking the trend and like dropping the expectation of like, it's going to go in a cookie cutter fashion, drop that expectation because it's not how it goes. And like that, when you drop it, it actually creates so many more opportunities. Like when I figured that out, I was able to add a master's program, something totally different, which led to creating a whole new category of sport management, like, which has had created so many opportunities. Like, and I just can't even begin to imagine like what my experience would have been had I gone with the cookie cutter version that they had like prescribed. So that's number one, is like, ignore that. That's not like, it doesn't have to work that way. Mm-hmm. It can work. If you're a person who just like prefers a lot of structure, like absolutely by all means, but like, it doesn't have to. So that's one. And number two, I'm a big fan of the personal development curriculum, which like not a curriculum in the formal sense, like in the very informal, read a book that you're reading for yourself, learn about what you feel like you need to learn about. I've been very fortunate to when I started getting towards the end of my PhD, I started reading a lot of like novels and nonfiction. And like, that has just been so refreshing for me. And just thinking at the beginning of every year, like I try to jot down, okay, like here's what I need to dig into, or here's what I need to learn that isn't necessarily on the syllabus. And that's been great. And like in my first year, it was like how does sleep work in grad school? Like that was like my person, like, because I knew that like, if I get erratic about my sleep schedule, I turn into a grumpy insert bad word here.
Right.
So like that wasn't going to work. So like that was first year. Like second year, it was just all about, I have to understand how this university system works like really well and how things transfer within it and how people interact within it so that I can do a better job of like advocating for myself being in two different programs and like all of that. So like that was second year. Third year was like more about like learning how to be a faculty member and learning what that relationship is and all that. Like, but like whatever it is, like there's stuff that's not necessarily on the syllabus that like you need to think about, and it has to be a personal experience. And like that learning curve is very personal, but like be intentional about it because I think it'll improve the outcomes overall. So those are the two, just buck the trend of like, it's going to work the same way for everybody, because that's just not true. And to like develop whatever it is your personal curriculum each year. And even if that's like, I want to read a bunch of novels, or like, I'm going to binge watch Tiger King plus whatever else comes up that's ridiculous on Netflix. Whenever it comes up, and I'm going to drop everything to do it, like whatever that is, I don't really care. Just like lean into it, because that's what makes it cool. And like, that's what makes it personal. And that, I think that's what leads to success and differentiates you at the interview table. If you have the privilege of having an interview at a school.
I love that you said that, because I feel like mine in the last year was start a grad student podcast and challenge the system and burn it all down. So like, I really vibed with that, but also I'm simultaneously, my partner and I are watching all seasons of Survivor in order from the beginning, because we'd never watched it before. We're on season 20.
Yeah.
Right. So we're on season 20. Yeah. We don't know what happens. If you've watched, don't say anything. But that's like another thing in my free time. I'm crocheting. So like, I have all these little projects that like kind of bring me to task related things that are fun, that are separate from grad school. I feel like my takeaways are a couple of them. First, I mean, I think it's very evident, like, even if you plan, it's probably going to go how you don't expect it to go. Whether that be like literally because COVID interfered, or in your case, like you had multiple jobs and job offers during grad school that you could not have predicted, or wouldn't have even dreamed of perhaps, that you were going to like hold a tenure track job graduating. And also just a reminder of like how broken the system is, right? So the fact that you paid $13,000 to defend, you know, and it kind of makes me wonder, right? Like, had you just waited a month or two months and had COVID hit, would they have waived that? I don't know. Right. So just reminding yourself, the system is still in control, and like, that's really messed up, but it's just a reminder. And it kind of relates to a previous episode that a guest gave advice about, which was that, and I think this was Jarilli Javier. She said, you got to look out for you because everyone else is kind of looking out for themselves, and not in like this really dramatic, like sad way, just like you have got to look out for you, and that is it. So I think that would be a takeaway that I also got from this. And I guess the other one would be that I have just not had the same life experiences, because man, I've never worked at the Olympics, but I'm just still thinking about that story. That was incredible. No, but just, you know, don't forget to experience life along the way. I think that's a big one. Like, as I hear your story, I'm like, you just can't be afraid to go for it.
Yeah. Be a person. Like, I think, you know, when we think about, I have a friend who like on Twitter, her tag or whatever under her name was like whittling away my 20s in the lab. It's just like,
it's too relatable.
That felt so real in that moment. Like, you read it and you're like, shoot, she's right. Damn it. Like, find those opportunities. And frankly, like, some great opportunities cost money. That sucks. But like, that's like the way of the world. Like, but there are some that don't, that are in your community, that are nearby, and just lean into all of those. Like, be a person outside of academia too, because you know, academia does not love you back. So
absolutely true. And you say that even as someone whose family is in academia. Like, academia doesn't love anyone. Maybe like old white men. I think it loves old white men.
It does, but only once they're old.
Yes,
like, and that's the other part too, is like, you know, my partner is like a white dude, right? And like, he's straight cis white dude, young, finishing his PhD young, and has all kind of, and like, I'm sure he doesn't care that I'm saying this, like, has all kinds of imposter syndrome, like, because that's just the experience. Like, you know, so like, yes and no. And I think, like, does he have it way easier than a bunch? Like, 100%.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. But like, so do I, right? Yeah. Let's not forget that. And there's just layers and layers and layers and layers to all of this. And we could get into it for hours, but like, it's going to be a unique experience for every person, and recognize that early so that you don't feel like you're supposed to live up to somebody else's version of what this looks like.
Wow. I feel like I needed that advice today. So thank you. But we are at the end of this episode. Thank you so much for joining me for this. I really have just loved hearing your story and hearing your perspective. And again, like, this is one of the first post-PhD perspectives. I did have Dr. Emily Roberts on. She hosts the Personal Finance for PhD podcast. We talked a lot about finances, but we didn't really get into the PhD. So you are really just providing such valuable insight sort of into that look. And I think older grad students will do this for younger grad students of like, when I was a first year, I wish I would have. But this just like overall reflection and look into grad school is so valuable. So thank you so much for coming on and chatting about that.
Yeah, anytime. And like, if people want to follow me or like message me on Twitter, I'm always happy to like share my experience or give advice or send you to resources or whatever it is I can do to help make your experience better. So be sure to reach out.
What a seamless transition to me now saying, where can people connect with you online as we sandwich this episode with the other half of the social media shout out?
Yeah, teed you up. So Maddie J. Orr is my personal one and my nonprofit, which works in the sport ecology world. If you're into like the Olympics and FIFA World Cup and climate change, is at Sport Eco Group on Twitter.
Amazing.
Both of those, follow, tweet at us.
Yeah. And then she also has a website, of course, that would be linked in the description. This was just so great. Thank you so much for your time today, spending a little Sunday morning with me. I hope you had a good time.
Yeah, it's always good to have this conversation. Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, Maddie, for the millionth time, thank you so much for joining me. Listeners, thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Hashtag bye. Are you looking for more ways to connect with Dear Grad Student? Well, you can check out the podcast at the podcast website, all made possible by podcast patrons at deargradstudent.com. You can also find the podcast on Twitter at Dear Grad Student, on Instagram at Dear Grad Student Pod, and automated closed captionings can be found on YouTube for some episodes by searching Dear Grad Student Podcast. If you would like to join the wonderful, amazing people supporting the podcast on Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/deargradstudent. We are only a few patrons away from 20. I would love to hit that by my birthday. That's June 24th. If you want to join, go for it. This is also helping to fund the transcripts, which are going live for some episodes now. Stay tuned for more on that later. If you just want to connect with me online, you can find me on Twitter at @Alana_Gloger. That's ELANA_GLOGER. And if you like what you heard today, you can tell every single person you know. If you have a new member coming into your lab, or if you just know somebody who needs a little bit of support, or if you just think someone would like me talking for a long time, make sure to send them this podcast. You can also find merch on the podcast website. And if you can, please go ahead and follow Dear Grad Student on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave a review wherever reviews can be left. And as a reminder, all resources and links mentioned in today's episode can be found in the description. And until next time, warmest regards, best wishes, sincerely, Alana.